Good evening. My name is Catherine McNamara, and I'm a student supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Community Studies Center, and the Departments of Middle Eastern Studies, Religion, and Sociology, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, A Mosque Near Ground Zero. The 9/11 site is hallowed ground, and it is too painful and divisive to build a mosque there, says Roy Barnes, the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. It is insensitive and disrespectful to locate a mosque or an Islamic center at a site that was damaged at 9/11, says Representative John Shimkus, Republican of Missouri. We would betray our values and play into our enemies' hands if we were to treat Muslims differently than anyone else, says New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I want tolerance. I want inclusion. And there is no better embodiment than this project, says Valerie Lucinikowski, whose nephew died in the September 11th attacks. The planned construction of Park 51, an Islamic community center two blocks from Ground Zero, has become a debate about September 11th, Islamophobia, constitutional guarantees, and American identity. In the latest opinion poll conducted by Quinnipiac University and released on August 31st, a majority of New York State voters, 54-40%, agree that because of American freedom of religion, Muslims have the right to build the mosque near Ground Zero. However, the same majority, 54-39%, agrees that because the sensitivities of 9/11 relatives, Muslims should not be allowed to build the mosque near Ground Zero. We are fortunate to have a distinguished panel with us today to discuss various aspects of the controversy. Hussein Ibish is a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine and executive director of the Hala Salam Maksoud Foundation for Arab American Leadership. Ibish is editor and principal author of three major studies on hate crimes and discrimination against Arab Americans. Michelle Borstein is a religion reporter for The Washington Post. She is very interested in young Muslim Americans and with how the Obama administration manages complex church-state issues. Eric Love is adjunct professor of sociology at Dickinson College and a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of California. His dissertation, entitled Confronting Islamophobia, Civil Rights Advocacy in the United States, considers the ways in which advocacy organizations have worked to address racialized Islamophobia since 1980. Our moderator, David Commons, is professor of history at Dickinson College. A specialist in modern Islamic thought, Commons' publications include A Historical Dictionary of Syria and The Wahhabi Mission in Saudi Arabia. At this time, I'd like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. And please hold all your questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because the program is being taped, and out of courtesy to those audience members who are hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question. And if you are interested in continuing the conversation, there will be a debate sponsored by the college's Union Philosophical Society about this same topic directly following the event. The debate will be held in Denny Hall, room 317. All are welcome to attend. And now please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Good evening. Each panelist will begin with a discussion of about 15 minutes, and Michelle Borstein will be the first speaker.
Hello. Thank you for coming. I cover religion at the Washington Post, and I thought it might be productive for me to tell you a little bit about how I think about these stories and this subject, because it might be some, you might relate to it, because it's sort of trying to get at what are the important themes and things going on behind these stories. So I would just start by saying something that I think is obvious, which is that journalists that cover this, including myself, are just regular human beings. So the things that we think are the most important stories, every reporter would be writing different stories about this subject. So I just encourage you to, when you're reading the news, just to try to remember that we're bringing all of our own baggage to this. We personally, when we're covering very explosive news things that are going on, like you know, what's going to happen probably in Florida this weekend with these Quran burnings. What we're trying to do is say, what are what we call smart stories? And what I would call a smart story is something that you can look back at in a year or 5 years or 10 years and say that we illuminated something that was behind this. So again, I'm just trying to encourage you to think about, when you look at these news things, there's many different levels. When you talk about Islamophobia or the Muslim Project near Ground Zero or the Quran burning, you could look at it from a political perspective, you could look at it from a sociological perspective, you could look at it from a theological perspective. So just encourage you, when there's the rhetoric is very high, to keep trying to come back and ask yourself what are behind these things, and don't get swept up in sort of, you know, very simplified ways of thinking about this, because that's what we try to do, sometimes successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully. So one thing that that we were thinking about in this subject is the subject of Islamophobia. And it's become, we've been talking about it so much in recent weeks that we often repeat, it's on the rise, it's on the rise. So I wanted to try to unpack that a little and say, when we write about that, we're saying, is that a fact? What is actually going on with sentiment towards Muslim Americans? And there isn't a lot of hard data about it. There's general polls. We look at places like the FBI has some data about hate crimes. It tends to be very outdated. There are large organizations like the Council on Islamic American Relations. There's the Southern Poverty Law Center, people that are interested in hate crimes data. But so far, we really haven't been able to say for a fact what's going on. So we're discussing, is sentiment changing towards Muslim Americans in this country? One thing that that I've thought about in trying to approach these stories, when we talk about, you know, Islamophobia seems to be rising, is it more vocal, is that in stories that I've been writing about the Muslim American community, we could sort of make another argument. We could say that the Muslim American community, a good percentage of which is relatively new to this country, immigrants to this country, is growing, is just coalescing. The civic organizations are just coming together. That in my sense, there are some benchmarks that show that the Muslim American community is on the rise in some ways. I mean, you have the election of the first two Muslim American congressmen in the last few years. You have the creation of Muslim American institutions, such as the Muslim American colleges, imam training, accredited imam training. So these things, I try to think about these things when I'm thinking about Islamophobia, that there's also this other current going on. So when we talk about, again, stories like the story that I wrote that prompted my invitation here was about some of the bloggers that opposed the project in New York. So we also think about, you know, the way that our communications culture works and the, you know, the grassroots that goes on the blogosphere. So anyway, in thinking about Islamophobia, I was kind of trying to encourage you to think about what we think about in the newsroom, which is it really on the rise? Is that where our lens should be? We're talking, for example, today about, you know, how should we address this subject of what's going to go on in Florida this weekend? You know, part of us says, you know, this is a crazy thing. This is a small community. Why are we even paying attention to this? On the other hand, there's so much going on around it. You have the context of all this discussion about the project in New York and the polls that surprised some people, including me, to see so much opposition to it. You also have, again, just to sort of let you in a little bit about the discussions we have in the newsroom, we were also looking at, you know, how is this being seen in the Muslim world, which is where obviously the vast majority of Muslims live. So we were looking to major Muslim world media that are based in the United States to ask them, are they planning on covering this event in Florida? What interest do they see in it? So we get into a situation where everybody's covering it and the news cycle is going on and on. But again, to try to back up and say, what's important about this? Is what's important, if anything? Is there something important going on at that church, or is it the reaction to it? Today you saw some military officials, the White House, commenting about it. So anyway, when we think about Islamophobia, that's some of the things that I'm thinking about. Is it really on the rise, or are you watching a churning of a lot of things? Muslim American civic organizations, grassroots organizing on the web, et cetera. So a second point I wanted to talk about was the causes of anti-Muslim expression. Anybody that writes about Islam in the mainstream media, and this may be true in general, knows that there is virulent prejudice against Muslims. That's like the number one thing that you can count on getting: angry emails, profane emails. I mean, it's just, you know that you're going to hear an outpouring from people who have very hateful things to say. So there's no question that that exists. One of the things when I was trying to write about the project in New York and think about, well, why is this, what's going on with this? What's causing this opposition, or what is this about? Is this about growing Islamophobia? And so I wound up writing about a community of bloggers that, in my belief, were very involved in connecting that project to other smaller mosque construction projects. They had Facebook sites that could organize people to come to community meetings. So that was one of the arguments that we made in one of our stories. These are people that you readers should know about. You might not know about them, but they're actually influencing things that you think about. After that story, obviously, like anything about religion, get a lot of criticism. So there was a lot of criticism from people who were supporters of those bloggers, and also some people that said, why are you making it seem like it's about a bunch of bloggers? It's really, it's a real thing. It's, you know, that I was trivializing something that, you know, was about more than just a few bloggers. So in terms of anti-Muslim expression, one thing is I think that the media climate plays a role, and I was trying to make that point make that argument in this one article. Another thing about sort of reaction to or expression of anti-Muslim sentiment, I believe has to do in part with the Muslim American community. I'm generalizing. The Muslim American community is extremely diverse, but where they're at in their place in time in this country, the Muslim American community is very, very diverse. Unlike some other very small religious communities like the Jewish community, it's the most diverse. Surveys have shown it's the most diverse. I mean, so they tend to be, you know, population of people that may or may not necessarily identify with each other ethnically, educationally. I mean, it's just a diverse community. So I think one of the things that you're seeing is the evolution of this community so that they can react to things like this. A lot of times when you hear or listen to or interview or read what's going on with young Muslim Americans, there's a lot of discussion about who speaks for them. So, I mean, you have this project, and then people say, well, why isn't the Muslim American community yet doing this? Or why isn't the Muslim American community reacting or speaking out about 9/11 or speaking out about this? There's still a lot of organization and churning and debate about that. So I think to me that's one of the things in covering young Muslim Americans that I've been very interested in, is watching sort of the civic development. I mean, I mentioned Congress, and I mentioned, you know, some of the educational institutions, voter registration. I mean, there's a lot of things to do with that, the community and where they're at in this period of time, in my view. Then obviously one of the things that you saw about this project was people raising national security concerns. So then you obviously get... Some people say that's outrageous. You know, how can you talk about, you know, there being extremism in mosque? You don't talk about that when you talk about a Buddhist project or, you know, synagogue or a Presbyterian church or whatever. But I think that if you listen in on if you listen in on those debates about national security, there's definitely nuances. I mean, there's things that, you know, make all of us uncomfortable. People talking about, you know, what's being said at mosques, that kind of thing. But you also do have people within the Muslim community talking about wanting to have figures that can, you know, speak for them on these subjects. Another big area of interest to me in all this is religious freedom. So when I say religious freedom, people say, do Muslims have the right to build the mosque? But religious freedom, those two words mean a lot more than that. They're a catchphrase for a whole range of things. They're not just having the legal zoning right. But it has to do with the acceptance of the community. I mean, at this point, you can say, can they build this project there, even if they have the legal right to? Has there been so much prejudice and craziness that they won't really have the freedom to build it because they won't be able to? It'll just be too controversial. It'll have security concerns, all this other stuff. And I was thinking about, in listening to the pastor, Terry Jones, the gentleman in Florida, was today I heard him speaking a little bit about why he says he needs to go forward with this. And he threw out these words, religious freedom, and he talked about censorship. I mean, these are things that spark the ears of a lot of people, Muslims as well. I mean, I haven't been following him long enough to know if he's kind of changed his rhetoric and what motivates him besides just sheer prejudice. But I mean, when you hear people talking about religious freedom, that to me as a religion reporter conjures up, you know, a lot of stuff that you should think about. I mean, religious freedom to a lot of people means the right to be able to build houses of worship in other places in the world, He's sparking people who may think he's just, you know, a radical will say, well, why can't, you know, missionaries do their work in, you know, Muslim country X or whatever? So there's a lot of people, and there's also, you know, a lot of Muslim Americans are concerned about censorship issues when you talk about cartoons and all this other. So, I mean, within these kind of small kind of things that can seem like, you know, you just dismiss them because they're so full of hatred. But there's other currents that are going on. We're trying to see if we can find out, are there people in the, you know, are there religious leaders who have tried to reach out to this guy? I mean, anyway, I'm just trying to let you in on a little bit of how we try to think about what's behind some of this. And the last subject I just wanted to mention very briefly was just general religious prejudice in the United States. I think my sense is that a lot of from stories that we do about big demographic studies, the few demographic studies that are done about religion, because the U.S. Census is forbidden from asking about it. So religion is actually something that we don't know as much about as maybe as we would like, or about some other subjects. That I think from covering the subject, most people do not know that much about their own faith. They can't identify what their denomination believes. They can't, and Muslim Americans have been asked to, you know, to articulate a wide range of things that the average person may not know or hasn't thought about or has nuanced feelings about, just like most people have about their faith identity. But so when I look at those studies, a lot of times what I think is that a lot of this is just, there's a very tribal element to just how we feel about people who are like us or not like us. I was at a little dinner this weekend. This is just some small little anecdote, but I was at this dinner this weekend, and it was a group of women. They were in Washington talking about this project, and somebody said, you know, I pride myself as, you know, journalist, religion reporter, that I can talk about any of these things. And so one of the women said, you know, that really what was behind it were the Jews. Which I'm Jewish, so I kind of noticed myself get my back up over it. I don't know if she was referring to, you know, I know there's been writing about the some of the funding behind some of these bloggers, but I mean, I think that you have to remember that that we all have these kind of tribal things that I believe that we're still work through when we think about people of other religious communities. And even what our religious identity is. This is slightly off the topic, but I mean, a lot of the stories that we've done about religious identity shows that religious identity in this country is very fluid right now. I mean, something like over 40% of American adults, when they ask them what box they check, they say that box is something different than they were raised as. So when we say, what are we? I mean, that, you know, a lot of times when we talk about Muslims believe or Jews believe or whatever, you have to remember what you and people that you know, the reality of how nuanced and complicated some of these things are. So anyway, when I was thinking of speaking to a bunch of students, I was just trying to think, don't let this get so simplified that you just say, you know, Islamophobia is bad and then you're done with it, because there's a lot of interesting stuff behind it. Anyway, that's all.
Thank you. All right, now we'll hear from Mr. Ibish.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for turning up in a really nice evening. I appreciate that. I want to look at this controversy, so-called controversy, I should say, as I really think it was eminently avoidable, and it's sort of absurd in many ways, but it is a controversy nonetheless. So I want to think about it a little bit in terms of the different narratives and the way narratives function culturally and politically in our society. I'd like to begin by saying something that I know a lot of people don't agree with, but I think it's worth pointing out. And I think this controversy has played itself out, and I think it played itself out a long time ago. I think the absolute last moment when it was going to have any lasting political effect was probably the second comment that President Obama made. I mean, he made a comment a few weeks ago to the effect, the rather anodyne effect, that, you know, speaking as a constitutional a law professor, he simply observed that Muslims had the right constitutionally to build a religious center wherever they wanted to, and I'd add also a private property right as well, I mean, within zoning restrictions. And that was fine. He caught some heat for it. The next day he said, well, I said they had the right. I didn't say whether or not it was a good idea. And that's the last thing he said about it. I think by that point, the whole thing in terms of narrative, the whole controversy in terms of narrative had played itself out. And what I mean by that is that the two competing narratives that exist within this controversy had been fully developed by that point. Now, on the one hand, you've got the Mayor Bloomberg version, which is This is the essence of our freedoms. Our tolerance, our religious liberty, our inclusiveness is essential. We betray ourselves, betray our principles if we don't allow this. And if we object to it, it's a kind of betrayal of the principles of the United States. He was about to cry when he gave that speech. I mean, he was really emotional about this and talking about the history of his Jewish community in New York. So, the other narrative, and President Obama kind of embraced it for a while and then sort of stepped away from it. That's fine. The other narrative, of course, is the range of objections to the project, which run a spectrum that begins with, this is terribly insensitive because of the emotions of the family or people of New York or the people of the United States, some version of that, all the way to, this is an extremist project by some radical quasi-terrorists building a victory monument to honor bin Laden. Basically. I mean, it's everything in between. But almost all the objections tap into some version or other of an Islamophobic sentiment, in the sense that, at the very least, there's a conflation of the 9/11 criminals, the murders on 9/11, the mass murder of 9/11, with Muslims in general, with Islam in general, etc., as if the two were somehow synonymous in a negative way, that there's some that somehow the 9/11 terrorists were representative of Islam, that they were representative of the Muslims of New York or the Muslims of the world, and therefore it's insensitive. I mean, the insensitivity argument is predicated on that conflation. Right? You have to have that, otherwise you can't even call it insensitive. And then, of course, as you go further and further to the right, if I may put it that way, you end up with increasingly shrill voices that are, become hysterical and overtly bigoted rather than implicitly bigoted. So all the objections, I think, to some extent or another, tag into some kind of prejudice, and I think it's important to note that. The other narrative that lurks in the background is the idea that American Muslims are victims. This is a very minor discourse. You can find it on the left and among liberals. There's that undercurrent. But basically, the binary is American values on the one hand versus something wrong with the Muslims, on the other hand. You know? And what I mean by the idea that the controversy has played itself out some while back, I mean weeks ago, is that I think almost everyone in this country who is going to take a position on which side they are leaning towards have probably already done it by the point of the second intervention by President Obama. Anyone who really cared enough to pay close attention probably had already a sense of where they came down on this issue by that point. I might be wrong about that, but that's certainly what I think. And because of that, I think I don't really have any doubt that unless something dramatic happens, and really the only thing I can think of that would qualify would be some kind of act of violence or vandalism directed towards the site or some of the people promoting the project or something like that, which I do not think is likely. But that would certainly provide a new framework for a re-engagement by many Americans. I mean, if something violent was done to the people who were doing this, then it would reframe things, no doubt about it, and would cause a re-evaluation of where people identified themselves in this range of opinions that I've laid out. But I think short of that, what we've seen here is another instance in the development of a much larger narrative, which is the narrative of Islamophobia in the United States writ large, and contrary narratives that push back against that. This American tolerance, diversity, religious liberty is a key one. It's not the only one, but it's certainly in this case it was the main one. Michelle asked a very interesting question, which is there really an increase in Islamophobia in the United States? And I think if you were talking over the last year and a half or 2 years, she's absolutely right. You can't demonstrate that. There's a lot of contradictory information, and then was that. I think if you were to ask that question, say, since 9/11, is there an increase in Islamophobic sentiment and discourse in the United States? The answer is unequivocally yes. I think the polls are very clear on that. I think there was more negative sentiment towards Muslims and Islam expressed by Americans in all the polls in 2005 than there was in 2002 and 2003. And there's more now than there was in 2005. So certainly if you looked at the last couple of years, you can't say, but I mean, looking over the last decade, we can see a clear progression. The extent to which that translates into hate crimes is very debatable. But clearly we see more opposition to not just this mosque project, but at least half a dozen others around the country, where in the past people would have certainly felt the need to couch their objections to a building of a mosque or an Islamic center in terms of some disingenuous claims about zoning or traffic or noise or parking or something like that. And in this case, in these six or seven cases I can think of are all over the country, people are not doing that. They're simply coming out and saying, well, there's a problem with Islam and there's a problem with the Muslims and we don't take kindly to your mosque around here, that sort of thing. So I don't think there's any doubt about it. Now, it is true that you've got a lot of interesting developments in a community that's growing and maturing and hopefully maturing in the direction of some serious political civic engagement. And there are signs of that at the local level all over the country, certainly. There are the two members of Congress, although they are from a very particular part of the Muslim community, that is to say the African-American Muslim community, and not immigrants or even children of immigrants. They are from a very different part of the community. And I would say they're both in Congress in spite of the fact of being Muslims rather than because of the fact of being Muslims. I can't see in either of their cases that it helped them. I think they just overcame it, which is a whole other way of looking at it. I would have to point out that there are four major national two major national Arab American organizations and which are older, and two major national Muslim American organizations that are younger, that are political organizations, not religious, not community, not civic, political organizations with a mandate to have a political impact and a political role. Each one of them, in one way or another, is either smaller or reduced in stature or less able to perform its functions now than it was before September 11. In other words, this community has not empowered itself. It has retreated. It has allowed its national organizations, political organizations at the national level, to atrophy. You can say that it has engaged in interesting, creative, powerful ways on many different registers. But at that particular register, which is probably the way most people would think you better organize yourself if there's a problem coming at you, they haven't done it. In fact, they've sat back and watched these things wither, and I think at least one of them is about to die. And another one is in suspended animation. It exists, but it can't do anything much. And the other two have serious problems as well. So this is a very, very interesting phenomenon. And I think it's worth pondering why that is. But what I want to do for a second is try to situate this so-called Ground Zero mosque controversy in a broader pattern of the way that this broader Islamophobic narrative has developed. I mean, first, let's step back for a second. And look at the elements of the issue. About 9 months ago, a local Sufi imam in New York called Faisal Abdul Rauf, sort of got partial control of a building with partial funding. Apparently, doesn't have that much. It's hard to say. No one really knows. And announced this Park 51 project. I have to say, I think only someone who exists in an absolute bubble would have failed to understand what the Islamophobic right would have done with this idea. Unfortunately, Imam Faisal and his friends do in fact live in a bubble. He's been accused by Islamophobes of being a radical imam. I've had my eye on this guy for 8 or 9 years. I can tell you I disagree with that passionately. As far as I can tell, everything that Imam Faisal does is dedicated to the greater glory of Imam Faisal, which makes him maybe not that different from a lot of clerics. He doesn't have a political agenda, but he has a personal ambition agenda. You want to know what he's like? Go to his website, the website of his organization. It lists him as imam, president, and visionary. I mean, anyone who can call themselves a visionary with a straight face is now in some kind of rarefied realm of stratospheric egoism. I mean, even politicians don't dare say such you know, hogwash. So, it's totally in this, okay, whatever. Anyway, the point is that, you had a very teenaged group of people doing this, and they just, I promise, surely did not have a clue what could be done with this information. And the people Michelle was describing, some of these ultra-right-wing bloggers, most notably Pamela Geller, who is a lady with a blog called Atlas Shrugs, who is stark raving insane. I mean, she's absolutely stir-frying crazy. That's all there is to it. I mean, she says President Obama is the illegitimate son of Malcolm X and things like that. I mean, she's absolutely... Oh, no, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Oh, no, she's a psychotic woman. I mean, she's absolutely a mental patient. This isn't metaphorical. I mean it quite literally. I promise you. Anyway, she got going, and some of her weirdo friends who may be cynical, or some of them also may be sort of doolally in touch, they got hold of this, and of course they shaped it. They defined it. They created the phrase Ground Zero Mosque, as we established already. It's not at Ground Zero. It's a few blocks away, next to... it's in Lower Manhattan. Everything's next to each. Everything's close to everything else. There's a strip club equally far from Ground Zero. There's a bunch of all kinds of weird stores and bizarre things. I mean, it's Lower Manhattan, yeah? So it's going to be near. And it's not a mosque, it's a community center. But they, this phrase, Ground Zero Mosque, and then everything that follows, this radical imam who's got an insane political agenda and likes the terrorists and all this stuff, the whole issue got framed that way. A couple of months ago, it leached into the right-wing fringe of the mainstream media, beginning with the New York Post, made its way very quickly towards the center of our public conversation, in a very toxic way, because it had been defined by a gang of extremists with a pre-existing agenda that was bigoted. By the time it arrived in a mainstream conversation, it was shaped in such a way that very few politicians, left or right, Republican or Democrat, had the guts to stand up and say, well, this narrative is wrong, let's look at this again. There's nothing, I mean, the guy may be self-serving, but he's certainly not an extremist, unless he's extremely ambitious or extremely self-centered or something like that. But politically extreme, no. And, there's no reason to be worked up about this. It became so toxic that you had not only Republicans running to say some of the things that were quoted, but also people who know very well better than that, like Harry Reid and Howard Dean. I mean, they're taking cover. That's exactly what they're doing, and you can't blame them. So that's really how this particular narrative got shaped. What I want to say is, insofar as it plugs into the broader evolution of an Islamophobic narrative in the United States, which, as I say, I think is the real reason why you have more anti-Muslim sentiment now than you did in the first 24 months after 9/11, which doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of an idea that these sentiments are tied to real threats and real events, but it does make sense if you think about how narratives actually function politically, right? They have to coalesce. They have to become coherent. They have to develop a group of people who push them and develop and create their audience as they go along. This is essential. So, events in the world, like an act of terrorism, do not produce a certain cultural effect. It's got to be refracted through an existing narrative, right? You've got to interpret it in a certain light. It doesn't just naturally produce sentiments. It depends how you interpret those events. We have a much more developed narrative about Muslims as a threat to the West and the United States now than we did then. So even without a terrorist incident, with the construction of the Islamic Center, proposed construction of the Islamic Center, you can have that same kind of affect. I just want to note that I think that the way this narrative has developed, and even this discourse, you could call it, has developed since 9/11, has been in spurts. And it's usually been tagged to existing events that happen in the real world, but not always. Sometimes there are just little moments of spasms of cultural outpouring from groups that want to shape this narrative, and we've seen that too. But usually it's been tied to specific things. I think the closest analog to this controversy was the controversy in 2006 about Dubai Port World. Dubai Port World is a major multinational corporation that runs ports all over the world. It bought P&O. including Pacific and Oriental, which is a British company. It bought one major multinational purchasing another major multinational. With that came P&O North America, which was part of P&O, and P&O North America had the contract on several major ports to run them, to manage them. Not security, not anything like that, just to run them. It's a port management system. So basically all that happened is the ultimate owner of this giant multinational shifted from an address in London to an address in Dubai. That's it. No change in personnel, no nothing. No, all nonsense. And again, there's no security role. We have our security services in the United States. So the idea that this was somehow threatening or problematic or bad was a complete fantasy. But it was very appealing to a lot of people on the right who don't like Dubai, don't like Arabs, don't like Muslims, and wanted to make a big stink about it. And populists who are, sort of without, the Lou Dobbs type who don't really have affiliations and just like to get people worked up. And also to a lot of Democrats, by the way, liberal Democrats, and people like Mr. Oberman, who made a big stink about it because it was an opportunity to trash the Bush administration, which was responsible for it. There's a lot of shameless partisanship on the left as well over this issue. And just as people find it necessary now to describe self-serving prelate, Mr. Raouf, as some kind of political extremist, which he isn't, they felt the need to describe Dubai, which is probably more like Las Vegas than anything else you can think of, as some kind of hotbed of Al-Qaeda or something like that, and an enemy to the United States, when it was a very close ally to the United States, and the whole United Arab Emirates is. Not every person there, but the government, clearly. So you just need to kind of frame anything and everything that becomes controversial as very, very threatening. Always bring everything back to 9/11, no matter what. In this case, it's very easy. In the case of Dubai Port World, it was a little more difficult, but it had to be done. And each time the narrative comes up, when there isn't sufficient pushback against it, and there isn't a serious effort to kind of calmly educate people that's successful, and where the narrative gets shaped, where the terms in which it's discussed are shaped by intolerant forces, the whole thing plays out fairly quickly. People choose sides. The competing ideas establish themselves, as I described in the mosque controversy, so-called, and people affiliate with one or the other, or they don't, which means they're never going to, and the whole thing dies down, only to reemerge again the next time, stronger than ever. And so, in other words, what I'm suggesting is what you're looking at is a cumulative effect, right? A cumulative effect of a series of so-called controversies, some of them real. The Fort Hood murders, for example, the massacre at Fort Hood by this so-called Major Hassan, mental patient and lunatic. And this, obviously, and some other incidents of violence and extremism, is extremely easy to plug in to an Islamophobic narrative, because there are, after all, extremist, radical Muslims, very large number, probably more of them than extremists of any other religion at the moment. Wasn't true 30 years ago, probably won't be true 30 years from now, but right at the moment, there is a very small subset of global Muslims who are politically dangerous and violent, and that's a fact. And it's not as if you had to choose between acknowledging the reality that there is this Islamophobic discourse being pushed by some very bigoted and hateful people operating from a variety of motives on the one hand, and that there is this group of dangerous extremist Muslims on the other hand. They're both true simultaneously, and they don't contradict each other at all. They're absolutely real. The final thought I want to leave you with is, overall, the biggest problem with the Islamophobic discourse and the Islamophobic narrative, and if you want me to describe what it is in detail, I'll tell you, ask me. It's a rehash of anti-Semitism. It's no different than the anti-Semitism in content. In content, it's no different at all. In fact, it's uncannily and eerily similar to the anti-Semitic discourse you might have found on certain parts of the political right in the United States between World War I and World War II. It's exactly the same thing. And I'll describe it for you if you want, but you have to ask me. Because I don't want to take too much more time, because I don't think I have any. The final thought, the most important thing, the greatest weakness of this argument is not its reductiveness, it's not its homogenizing of a very heterogeneous group of 1.3 billion people in the world, it's not its wild and inaccurate claims that it makes. It's the way it frames the existence and the political significance of this extremist movement, off the back of which it sort of took wing. because it frames Al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremists as basically the forward movement of a generalized Islamic and Muslim attack against the West. And this is completely wrong. What you're looking at is an internal conflict. It's not something that should be, as some people say, an internal conflict. It is an internal conflict in the Islamic world. I mean, these guys variously want to either overthrow all the governments that exist and replace them with new so-called Islamic governments, or in the case of the real severe extremists like Al-Qaeda, the most extreme, they want to do away with all governments and all states and replace them with some kind of generic kind of caliphate from Morocco to Indonesia. And this is, in other words, a very radical fringe within these societies, or series, sets of fringes that become smaller, smaller, and more violent as you go further and further to the political right, that are confronting, first of all, the mainstream of these societies, and more importantly, in many cases, almost every, and in some cases, absolutely every government in the Islamic world. So what you've got, in other words, is an internal conflict that spills over into the West. 9/11 was the most dramatic spillover you can imagine. But the idea that this is a generalized Muslim-Christian or Muslim-Western conflict is completely wrong in every possible respect. And I'll end with that.
Thank you. Okay, Professor Love.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Thanks to the Clark Forum for putting together this outstanding event and everyone else that was involved. I think this is great. Very honored and delighted to be on a panel with these two very distinguished guests. And I'm going to be very brief. I've already learned quite a bit tonight. The first thing I learned is that I need to take the word visionary off of my resume. So already this has been a very
unless you want donations.
Discussion for me. Yeah. Look, I want to be very brief. I have really just two things that I want to do. And the first is I want to talk about a little bit of the history, how we got to a place where this controversy happened. I want to do that first. Then I want to talk, again, this will be very brief, about where we go from here, the options that are available as we, meaning the United States, moves forward and tries to understand how a community of people, Muslims and others, can exist in the United States, where, how that works. Okay, so first, how did we get here? I think it's very important to note that one thing that struck me about the discussion around the community center in New York is how few voices there were during as the narrative expanded, as Hussein very thoughtfully described, as the narrative expanded, how few voices there were from Muslim Americans talking about what this means and just giving a perspective. Of course, Michelle has done some amazing reporting, and I think her work is clearly an exception to this, but I think for a lot of the reporting on this issue, these voices were either entirely absent or they were quite marginalized during the discussion, right? They appeared very late in the articles. They were placed on television alongside people who were clearly bigoted, these sorts of things. I think that's very telling. But it's not to say that there hasn't been any work on civil rights for Muslim Americans and others affected by these sorts of the discourse that we call Islamophobic, right? And I think Islamophobia itself, by the way, is a very strange term.
Yeah.
For many reasons. One is, it's a phobia, it's not always about fear, right, which is what phobia means, is a kind of fear. I think fear is very often part of the bigotry that happens here, but not always. So it's unusual to call something like this a phobia, a fear. So already that's an unusual term. Another way it's unusual is that very often Muslims are not the people that are affected by Islamophobia. The term that flies around in Washington, the collection of terms that you hear all the time, is Arab, Muslim, Sikh, South Asian communities. And that's because Arab Americans are affected by what we now call Islamophobia. And again, the statistics on religion are difficult to come by, but many Arab Americans are not Muslim. At the same time, Sikhs, who are not Muslim, they're Sikh, are also very much affected by what we call Islamophobia. very often because of the dastar or the turban that Sikhs wear, people will look at them and think that they are Muslim, and this becomes an issue. And then South Asians as well, who are neither Sikh nor Muslim necessarily, although a great many South Asian Americans are Muslim. Not all of them are. South Asians as well, very much affected by what we call Islamophobia. So thinking about that, I think it's important as we look at how we got to a place where this community center, a quintessentially local issue of zoning, and other cognate projects across the country, mosques being built in Tennessee, in San Diego, as Hussein said, there's about half a dozen of these mosque projects around the country, which normally have there's no national interest in this kind of issue. It's now a national issue, where and when mosques should be built. How this happens in the context of the United States, where we do have Arab, Muslim, Sikh, South Asian civil rights advocacy organizations that have been at work since the 1960s. How does this take place? I think it's important as we look at that to think about the ways that these organizations fit into our understanding of how civil rights advocacy works generally. I think if you look at the way that these organizations have worked, they've had essentially two choices, right? And one is these organizations can organize along a line of what we think of when we think about civil rights, which is the work of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in the 1960s, the work of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. These civil rights organizations that argue essentially, and others, many others that I'm not mentioning here, that talk about, they advocate for rights of an aggrieved community, right? A collection of people that are being targeted specifically as an aggrieved community, and they need protection. They need civil rights. They need extra protection in many ways, right? That's one hand, what these organizations could do. On the other hand, these organizations could choose to say, look, we're not representing an aggrieved group. We want to represent all Americans. We want to represent the rights of Americans generally. And this is what I think many people call a civil liberties approach, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that all Americans, regardless of their faith, regardless of their race, regardless of all Americans should have the right to X, Y, and Z. What we see, at least since 2001, and I think really since the late 1980s, is these organizations, Arab, Muslim, Sikh, South Asian civil rights organizations, doing the latter, making the case that what they want is better civil liberties for everyone. Mm-hmm. And they've chosen, I think, quite clearly not to pursue the civil rights avenue, the idea that we want to represent an aggrieved community. Mm-hmm. We represent a stigmatized minority group that needs special protections. Now, the implications of that strategic choice, I think, are still to be determined. It's something that I think is unclear, and we need to continue to question. I think we need to remember that there has been what we now call Islamophobia, has existed in the U.S. in one form or another for quite some time. Mm-hmm. It certainly didn't begin on September 11th, 2001. It didn't even begin, I don't think, with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I don't think it began with the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979. No. But all of these events have reminded people that we have this problem. And right now, and I think it's a little bit unusual that the current controversy over mosque construction came out of nowhere in many ways, right? There wasn't a precipitous event. It just sort of happened. And I think Michelle's reporting has done a lot to illuminate how that worked. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important. So that's unusual, that we're at a moment today where we're thinking about Muslim American, Arab Muslim, Sikh, South Asian American civil rights. And there hasn't been a kind of crisis moment other than suddenly this narrative appeared that we need to be concerned about mosque construction. I think that's also very interesting. So I think then as we look forward, right, and this is the thing I want to end with, as we think about where we go from here, that question, I think, between a civil liberties approach on the one hand and a civil rights approach on the other, well, I think continue to remain a very crucial distinction, a very crucial strategic question for the advocacy organizations that are involved in this area. I think the civil liberties approach has certainly been tried since 9/11, and I would argue earlier, since the late 80s. And I think the results are we have the emergence of this controversy virtually unchecked, right? This controversy happened, the narrative happened with very little response from the from Arab, Muslim, Sikh, South Asian community. And it's also, I think, quite telling that I read a quote earlier this week by Grover Norquist, who is an anti-tax crusader, conservative icon, with whom I would say I very rarely agree professionally. And I agree with him when he said earlier this week something to the effect of 10 years from now, and his argument essentially is that this controversy is counterproductive to the interests of conservatives in the United States. And the reason for that is he says, 10 years from now, what will be remembered about this controversy of the so-called Ground Zero Mosque will be very little, except the only people that will remember it are those who are affected by it. And he says the people that are affected that have fear right now are not just Muslims, but, he says, a collection of groups, including Arabs, including Jews, including members of other religious minorities in the United States. And he says it's very dangerous for conservatives, for anyone who has a political agenda, to alienate such a large group of Americans with this kind of rhetoric. I agree with Grover Norquist on this, and I think I think we need to question the origins of this controversy, and we need to look at, as we move forward, whether a civil liberties or a civil rights approach is the more appropriate as we move forward from here. I'll end with that. I want to get some questions.
Thank you for those most informative and somewhat provocative discussions of this issue. I've been requested to pose a few questions to the panelists in the hope that you might find them worth discussing. If not, then pass them over and we'll go straight to the audience. I go to the Arab world quite a bit for my work, and I'm planning to go to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates after this semester. And I'm sure that my friends there will say, David, what's going on in the U.S.? All right, and they'll refer to this mosque controversy. The last time I was there, they asked me about Dubai ports because I was there shortly after that. And I'm usually mystified because I don't study American society, politics, and culture, and I can't give my standard professorial explanation. And I say, I don't know. I don't understand Americans. Let's talk about Saudi Arabia, something I understand. Anyway, I'm wondering about three things. And one is your take on the suggestion that as an interfaith initiative, which this community center has been portrayed as by some people, is this perhaps wrong-footed? All right, that is, if their intention truly is to establish a center for interfaith dialogue, perhaps they'd be better served to relocate, acknowledging that they have a legal and constitutional right to that location, but that as a tactic of interfaith dialogue is wrong-footed. So that's one question. A second question, I wasn't taking notes in detail, but the impression I got was that this controversy is a manufactured controversy produced by crazy bloggers, crackpot preachers, and a general sense of prejudice and intolerance. And that may be true, but what I wonder is, how is it then that a majority of Americans polled in was it New York State, agree with this this narrative produced by crackpots and bigots? And does it say anything about the larger mood in the United States surrounding this, having to do maybe despair over the economy, despair over these endless wars in the Middle East? Is there some kind of connection? Is there a nesting, if you will, for such a controversy? And perhaps you think not. And finally, I'm struck. I do think that President Obama has been cowardly on this, and I think all the politicians who I think would, if elections were not looming and they were afraid of losing, they would speak out in defense of this project. There's a congressional election in upstate New York where the Republican candidate began by saying that the Muslims there have a right to build the mosque. His last name is Hanna. And his Democratic opponent criticized him and said, well, they have a right, but it's insensitive and it's wrong to do that. And then the Republican candidate flip-flopped. So I think you do have real cowardice among the national leadership that's reminiscent, mm-hmm. frankly, of 2002, 2003, mm-hmm. before the Iraq War, when people were afraid to express unpopular opinions. And, of course, it's naturalist to be expected. They want to hang on to their seats. But do you think that part of the success of the anti-mosque party is due to a failure of leadership at the national level to defend the right of the center to go forward?
I'd take a stab at the last one for sure. Yes, it is a failure of leadership, beginning with the leadership of the people who decided to do this thing. Because if you're going to do something like this, you have to be extremely careful to frame it in a way where it cannot be twisted the way it was. It was extremely predictable that professional Islamophobes would seize on it and try to define it the way they did. I think the backers of this project were unbelievably AWOL, in fact, in sort of absent without leave. And the efforts they have made to defend it have been absolutely counterproductive. I mean, ghastly. And with arguments like, well, we didn't find the building found us. It's the hand of God. I mean, what? Who do you think you're speaking to? I mean, this is disastrous, of course. And it gives you an insight into the thinking or lack thereof, the tin ear, the absolute, I mean, bubble that these people live in. And they still don't get it. To this day, they don't get it. And if they ever consulted with anyone who really knows what they're doing, I don't know about that. And my impression is they never did. And so, you know, I think the terrible lack of leadership there. The lack of courage and political leaders that you cite is right. Absolutely. If there had been a major pushback, I think the contrary example is actually George W. Bush, and immediately after 9/11, who took a very firm stand and said, listen, no. I think he saved lives. I'm sure he saved lives. I mean, there's the anti-blood on his hands in that case. I mean, he's sort of washed away. He did an excellent job. But President Obama hasn't done that. In fairness, it's difficult for President Obama on this issue. He has to be a little bit careful where he said. But I think everybody else could have been more forceful, and he too could have been a little more forceful than he was. There was a lack of boldness here. But it comes to your second question, though. How did it happen that so many people bought into this discourse? And it's precisely because the right-wing blogosphere was, and then the far right-wing of the mainstream media, the New York Post, etc., were allowed to define this issue. And by the time it was defined, it was too late. It was too late. And once people conceptualize this as the Ground Zero Mosque, it's going to be very hard to convince most Americans that it's perfectly okay if this happens, even while they might agree it's constitutionally protected and everything, they would still think it's insensitive. If it's framed the way the right-wing bloggers framed it, and then the New York Post and others, it is insensitive. You see what I'm saying? In a certain sense, the perception is reality. If you want to make it not insensitive, you have to define it in a way that's sensitive. You understand what I'm saying? And this is precisely the problem. So, no, it's... And which brings me back to your first question as well, and I'll let everybody else do it. But of course, it was really not a good idea at all from an interfaith point of view or any other point of view at all to do this project this way. If you're going to do that, you have to be very, very careful how you do it. You have to, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's. You have to be very, very careful that you shape it in a way that works in with the biggest coalition of people behind you that you can get, and not just charge off and say, well, it's the great visionary Imam Faisal, so it's okay. But it was never about him. And it was never about any of the little details. It was about the Ground Zero Mosque. The minute it's the Ground Zero Mosque, we're done for. Okay? Yeah.
I have one pretty unsexy point to make about interfaith, which is actually... Anyway, when your first point about just what would be an appropriate interfaith project, in some of the reporting that we were doing about this project, actually writing a profile of this visionary that he's talking about, we found that, I mean, basically that this guy was part of this, you know, part of this interfaith, mm-hmm. organized interfaith world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I take this subject very seriously. I wrote my master's paper on interfaith. So, I mean, I definitely don't poo-poo it as, you know, kumbaya or whatever the stereotypes are. But time and again, you heard in interviews that people who had worked with him in these groups hadn't really discussed with him, like, the first things that are going to come up by critics. I mean, like, the most, I mean, you could just dismiss it and say it's ridiculous, but, you know, what he said about Hamas and his father and the Muslim Brotherhood and certain things that you, and one of the people I spoke with that had been in projects with him, a rabbi, who had been with him on the day the Iraq War started. They were on a cruise together to Spain and Morocco. They were sort of like the entertainment on the cruise. It was like the imam and the rabbi. And he said, oh, we were watching the news about the Iraq War. And I said, well, what was his opinions about it? Because I was trying to find out about it. Basically, nothing controversial was discussed with him by anyone in interfaith. And I kind of just, again, because of my interest in interfaith, I thought, well, maybe this is part of the way interfaith works, is that part of the philosophy is, and I was kind of, anyway, part of the way the philosophy works is to not talk about the things that you know are going to divide you or that you might disagree on. And initially I kind of thought, and I wrote the article sort of saying, I mean, I think that's obviously kind of problematic. But on the other hand, I mean, if you're interested in interfaith, I mean, there is something to that, which is, you know, a lot of us can't talk about this stuff with our families. So, I mean, you're going to go to an interfaith group with, like, you know, Jews and Muslims or whatever, and you're going to go up to a stranger and start engaging them on something that you can't even talk to your family or friends about. So, I mean, I don't know how far you want to go on that, but I mean, in what's a productive interfaith project, I just thought it was kind of interesting that all these people in New York, which is this super diverse, you know, interfaithy place, and they're big interfaith centers, and they don't even talk about sort of these really, you know, obvious things because they felt it goes against the philosophy of interfaith. So anyway, that's something on the interfaith thing, but the second point was why is it whether it was manufactured?
If it's the product of crackpots.
Oh, right. Then how does it become
the dominant viewpoint in a nation of educated people?
Well, I mean, from you know, self-centered reporter point of view, I mean, that's obviously the most important question, because you're not really interested in the periphery. You're interested in, okay, well, if the majority of people don't support this, why? Mm-hmm. So you obviously have different, you know, options there. You can just say this is latent racism and, you know, bias, and, you know, that certainly may be true to my point about tribalism. But I think that the Muslim American community, I don't think this, if this has happened in 20 years, I believe that there is a lack of, like, organization, like a maturation of organization, that you didn't have people coming out right away, kind of not controlling the narrative, but certainly putting out their other narrative. And I don't just mean from wonky Washington groups. I mean cultural figures, Muslim cultural figures that everybody will know. So I think, I don't know if I'm getting off topic slightly, but I think that there are still issues that a lot of Americans started to engage with after 9/11, and you had lots of people racing to go take a class on Islam, and then everybody was like, oh, forget it. And then we kind of stopped really looking at whatever those issues are. So I think a lot of people still do say, well, you know, what is it about the status of non-Muslims in, you know, in the Quran or in Hadith or something? I mean, there are like a lot of things that people don't understand, and then these things get thrown at them, and it just springs up again. I mean, I guess to my point, I think there are actual issues that Americans still need to engage in that they started to after 9/11, whether it has to do with national security, the American foreign policy. I mean, you know, there's this whole explosion about the imams, you know, foreign policy views that are kind of standard on the American left. I mean, anyway, I guess that's why I think that it's kind of unwise to dismiss it as all crackpots, because I think there are real issues of like diversity. You know, when people still talk about this country being a Christian country. I mean, I was interviewing Pamela Geller, this blogger he's talking about, who, if you're really interested, you could see her in a bikini on our website talking about this subject, and then a bunch of people criticizing me. But anyway, maybe because it was in the context of this article about her. Okay. People said they were going to sue me for libel, that I was used the word that the word anti-Muslim was in the headline to talk about this woman. It's very interesting. But anyway, so she was saying to me, you know, and we wrote another story about the way the word Sharia has been used in this round of discussions about Islam. There's this whole thing about religious freedom, and, you know, that you know, Muslim, this creeping Sharia, that, you know, Muslim Americans are trying, Muslims and Islam inherently is trying to, you know, force sort of another religion on our country. This is this term that you occasionally see people using, creeping Sharia, and you see it on these signs at the protests near this project in Manhattan. And, you know, when I talk to her and other people, you know, that, to say, what is it that you see that Islam is starting to impose on this country? And they mention things like, when you ask them for specifics, they're talking about basically Muslim Americans asserting their rights mm-hmm. that you didn't see. And this is why I believe that Muslim Americans are, in some ways, on the rise. Mm-hmm. That's why I think this is a pushback against organization. Mm-hmm. They mention that Harvard University created a pool where there would be separate hours for women because of modesty and I think it was public schools that created space for Muslims to pray and things like that, that these are infringements. And I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, do say, oh, well, what about church-state separation? Yeah, I don't agree with that either. But then I was thinking how a lot of, you know, religious Christians and Jews in the past, like, 20, 30 years have been successfully able to argue that the public schools and public spaces should be able to accommodate more religion. I mean, that's something that we've written about a lot in the past 20 years, that there's been a, you know, march of cases that have gone all the way to the Supreme Court to argue successfully that religion had been discriminated against in the public space, that Bible studies should be able to use public schools after hours. I mean, there's a range of issues like this. So anyway, that's a long way of saying I think that, I don't know if you feel like you can, either of you can illuminate anything about this, but I feel like we're talking a lot about Muslim Americans, but I mean, I wonder what these discussions are like. You know, what are the most important discussions from the inside? I mean, in talking about, say, the framing of these arguments and the future of this project. And, you know, again, because I feel like there's a lot of discussion about Muslim Americans, but you don't see, and this is also, you know, our failure if we don't do this, you know, in the mainstream media, but to what degree, you know, what are the most important narratives that you should know as an educated person today among the Muslim American community about some of these things? I don't know if you guys have any.
Very, very briefly, I'd just say I think people are... Muslim Americans are shocked. They never stop getting shocked by these discourses. They don't understand where it's coming from or how it works, I don't think. I think they feel besieged and defenseless in an exaggerated way. There's a whole discourse among American Muslims that exaggerates the problem. It's hard to exaggerate it, but people manage to do it. And then that gets latched onto. And I think there is a subsection of our society that accords people who are assumed to have victim status based on their identity some kind of moral authority, and there's a subsection of the Muslim community that enjoys that and when kind of revels in its alleged victim status as well. And so there's this very pernicious sort of vicious circle that goes on. The other thing is about this particular controversy. I think there's a generalized sense that, you know, there's something very great at stake here, and that if the backers back down, if the center isn't completed, it will be some kind of major defeat, which I think is bizarre. I mean, it is to fetishize something that was never a great idea in the first place, was mishandled extremely badly, and I think the diminishing returns have become blindingly evident. Now, how you engineer your reassessment is a whole other matter. Another political opportunity there, a major one. But no one's thinking strategically or clearly about that.
All right, thank you. We're going to move to questions from the audience. All right, so.
Taking Q&A from both this room and the side room. So if you're sitting in the overflow room, you're welcome to walk in here so the panelists can see you ask a question.
Sorry.
Hello? Maybe I have a question about the two Barbara? Congressmen I have two questions about the congressmen mm-hmm. who were elected despite their Muslim identity. Mm-hmm. You said that they didn't represent the main population of Muslim, and I was wondering why.
Well, I didn't say that they don't represent the main population. What I said is they come from a very particular subset of the American Muslims, that is the African-American Muslims. The bigger group, maybe 60 plus percent approximately. It's very hard to know, as Michelle pointed out, Census Bureau can't ask about religion, therefore we really don't know. You could have a major funded study to do it, no one's bothered, and it would be still questionable. But some such guess of perhaps 35-40% of the Muslims in the United States are African Americans who either they converted or their parents or their grandparents converted, rather than immigrants, children, and grandchildren of immigrants, you see? And so what I'm saying is these are very different experiences. The African-American experience, even when it has a Muslim component plugged in, is one kind of history. And various immigrant communities is a very different kind of experience in the United States. It's a very different relationship to the United States. It's a very different... everything is different, I think. And I think the fact that both these members of Congress are African-Americans who happen to be Muslims, yeah? And neither of whom have Muslim names, by the way, Keith Ellison and Andre Carson. And they're both liberal Democrats representing liberal Democratic districts. And in fact, Mr. Carson virtually inherited the seat from his mother, who was a long-serving member of Congress and died unexpectedly. He became he filled her seat for, and then he got elected, re-elected into that position. So, my point here is simply that you can't look at this and... You have to acknowledge what Michelle's saying, which is, you know, this is really significant, and this is major, and it's something, you know, that demonstrates a real evolutionary moment for American Muslims. But at the same time, I don't think it tells you much about where people of Pakistani, Arab, Iranian heritage or something else heritage are, because it's a very different history and experience. I'm talking about representation. I'm talking about how much you can take those two things and extrapolate about the bigger subset of American Muslims. You see?
So it doesn't, I guess, but can you say, like, the bigotry is more experienced by black Muslims? No, not by, like, Arab Muslims.
Well, I think that's a double whammy. I'd call that a double whammy, actually. Yeah, I mean, you know, I still think the greatest bigotry in the United States experienced by anybody is bigotry against African Americans. I don't think there's any community that can bewail the same history and the same present reality of it. So, I mean, if you're going to experience both racial and religious prejudices at their more extreme forms at the same time, that's quite an interesting thing to deal with.
If you don't mind, a couple, if I could, it's a great question. I have, like, two things to say. One is... I agree with what Hussein said here, and although there have been actually two studies that have tried to be comprehensive on Muslim Americans, but there's still by no means the final word on the statistics, what percentage of Muslims are African American and so on. But in the case of Keith Ellison and Andre Carson, I think Hussein's absolutely right to say they were elected not because they're Muslim. Certainly, they didn't run on being... Keith Ellison wasn't running in Minneapolis saying, you should vote for me because I would become the first Muslim American member of Congress. This wasn't a platform for him. I'm not saying that it should have been. It simply wasn't. I think it's important to note that there is a long history, and one that is particularly visible today, but there's a history of political exclusion of groups that... Of ethnic and religious groups in the U.S. politically. And Arab Americans, Muslim Americans have certainly seen their fair share of this. The earliest case that I've seen that's documented is from 1921, a man running for office named Philip Heaty. His opponent in the campaign had placards that said, the argument was that, first of all, Syrians, which was the colloquial at the time for Arab Americans, that Syrians shouldn't be allowed to vote at all. And the man running in this campaign against Philip Heaty, who was a Syrian American, his opponent said, I don't want the Syrian vote. If I can't get elected without it, then I don't deserve to be a member of whatever he was running for. I think it was Congress. So that's 1921. All the way to the present day, there's an ongoing controversy in Southern California, the details of which escape my visionary mind. There's a man running for office in Southern California, I believe in Los Angeles County, who is, in fact, Egyptian-American, but he's hidden this fact from the voters. He was recently outed, for lack of a better word, as being an Egyptian-American and Arab-American. and has been placed on the defensive on both sides. There are those saying, my goodness, how could you hide this crucial fact from us? It's such an important national security issue that you identify yourself as an Arab American that changes the way I think about your candidacy. And on the other side, Arab Americans who say, look, we're all about you being a member of Congress, but how could you hide your heritage from, why is it so shameful? And I think the reason is quite clear. Running for office in the United States as an Arab or Muslim is difficult. It's something where President Obama, who is neither Arab nor Muslim, very famously has had to deal with increasing numbers of people who believe that he is Muslim, wrongly believe that he is Muslim. So the exclusion, I think, continues to be real, even though we have two Muslim American members of, mm-hmm. of Congress.
In my mind, when I think of the 9/11 attacks, I also think of the attacks in London, in the London Underground. Do you think if there was a mosque community center to be built near those sites, there would be a similar reaction in England, or do you think they would have a very different reaction from our country?
I don't know enough about those locations. I mean, I don't feel like I could answer that intelligently.
Well, there were buses, and the one in Spain also. I mean, they were not as big. No one regards those streets or the underground stations as hallowed ground. Not the same kind of
discourse.
Are you
basically saying, how does Europe handle this subject or something broader than that?
Yeah. That's,
well, that's whole other ginormous subject, which I don't know that much about, but I could say a couple little things. I know. Well, I mean, you often hear people talk about, make this comparison, which was, you know, like you're talking about narratives. This narrative that Europe had this enormous explosive thing going on with trying to integrate, you know, they had, you know, longstanding old Muslim communities, and then they had all these immigrants of new Muslim communities and different economic pressures, and then you also have, you know, anyway, there has been this narrative for years that the tensions about Islam were much greater in the in Europe than they were here in the United States, and then in the last, you know, few months, you've heard people say that's actually not true, that, you know, in the United States we're, you know, despite having completely different histories, that, you know, we actually have, you know, the same issues because we haven't had votes about headscarves and all these other things that got centered around that. But my understanding is that, you know, that in, well, as he said, you know, they don't have, you know, these specific locations that are you know, so significant. Anyway, I don't really have that much data about it because I don't know much about the integration
well,
issue there.
So. I think it's more difficult in Europe, both because there are very few European countries that have the really difficult to assail constitutional protections that we have that are sweeping as we have. And the other thing is that the nature of the immigrants from the Middle East to Europe is quite different than the nature of the immigrants. In other words, there's a class difference, an education difference, a difference in the way they relate to discourses in parts of the Middle East or in South Asia, and a lot more extremism as well. I mean, this homegrown extremism, so-called, in the United States is a very unusual phenomenon. It's very rare, it's very fringe, and it's very marginal. I think there are parts of Europe where it's really not none of those things. It's still fringe and marginal, but not to the same extent. And I think you've got European societies that are a lot less used to being diverse and having all kinds of immigrants coming in. And it's I'd much rather be dealing with this situation in the United States than go over to Europe and deal with it there. I'm a lot happier both with the American Muslim community and with the United States than I would be, say, with Britain and the British Muslims, where I think I'd feel a lot more uncomfortable with that situation, about both about the society and about the minority group. That is just being frank.
Thank you. Hi, my question is directed towards Mr. Abish.
Mm.
In your opening statements, you stated that if you were to use the argument of sensitivity against the Islamic Community Center from the viewpoint of it is insensitive to the families of the victims, you stated that that argument has to be predicated on the fact that there is some level of intolerance, however small.
Yeah.
Can you clarify that a little more?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I think let me clarify actually. What I mean is that the only way it functions as an effective argument is if the unstated implication that renders it insensitive conflates the idea of a community center or a mosque, if you will, let's call it either way, with the perpetrators of 9/11, the idea of anything that is Muslim or Islamic with the perpetrators of 9/11. In other words, that somehow this legitimately represents some aspect of what the killers were trying to do, all right? And that they somehow did actually speak in behalf of Islam and the Muslims in some way, or at least there's enough of a connection to make this a bad thing. Now, I do think there's another kind of sensitivity argument that I was actually making from this stage, which is that if you're going to do this risky thing, you better make sure to get the sensitivities right. Now, that's a different kind of critique. But I think the sensitivity argument that, say, a lot of the mainstream politicians who've taken this up, and people like Palin and Romney and Gingrich, they don't say Islam is bad, Muslims are bad. They say just move it. It's too close. It's hallowed ground. I mean, we had some quotes at the beginning that were like that. And it all rests on an unstated implicit subtext that there is some kind of connection between this religion, this vast universe of mankind, this thing that is followed now by one-fifth of the people in the world and is one of the largest traditions of humanity for the past 1,500 years, and the actions of a very small organization and 9 particular lunatics backed by a few more lunatics. And that, in other words, at a certain moment, you can't ever really separate Islam and the Muslims on the one hand and the mass murders at 9/11 on the other hand. That's what I mean. I hope that clarifies it a little bit.
I have another question. So
sure.
How would you feel about if the unstated argument wasn't so much about intolerance, but more so about unease? Because it has only been 10 years.
Well, I think
it's a pretty still fresh wound in the minds of those who lost family members or who were affected.
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think if it is a matter of unease, then it could really be a matter of dialogue, right, rather than a flat-out objection. So in other words, I have faulted the backers of the project for not getting it right, for not talking with people, for not preparing everybody, for not framing the issue in an intelligent way, allowing it to be defined by, frankly, a gang of weirdos and bigots, very marginal people with just websites that are not read by a lot of folks, but they still managed, because they were left an open field for many months, they managed to define the thing. I would also say that the people who picked up this argument in terms of sensitivity, who may themselves conceptualize it in terms of unease, right, have really not lived up to their responsibility to engage in any kind of dialogue either. So you've got a lot of very clumsy handling of, let's assume that everyone operated, everyone in this sphere we're talking about now is operating out of basic goodwill and basically being reasonable. The least you can say is they're all being very clumsy. That's the minimum, right? Certainly, very few people have gotten it right in any kind of consistent, coherent way. And the only people, it seems to me, who've managed to get out of it are people who've taken a very clear moral stance based on tradition and history. I think Bloomberg is the clearest example of that. It's true he doesn't deal with the sensitivity issue. He just bulldozers over it. But he does it with such passion and based on such a deep history in New York, including a Jewish history in New York, that it actually is extremely powerful. And it works for me, even though I think it was a bad idea. Sorry.
I think it's hard to gauge how uneasy people actually feel about it. Like, if this hadn't blown up and, somebody did a poll just randomly and said, what would you think about this? And somebody said, oh, I don't think it's a great idea. But they're not going to stand on the corner and like protest. It's hard to know how uneasy. I mean, are people really think this is important? Yeah. I mean, but I strongly agree with you. You know what I mean?
I mean,
it's
exactly
hard to sort of really get at how deep the unease, prejudice, whatever it is. But I think it is hard. I don't disagree with you that it's hard to sort of at its root say, is there, what is it that's making people uncomfortable or sensitive? I mean, is it basically just a lack of comfort, discomfort with Islam?
Yeah.
That, you know, it's hard to totally banish that from this, I think.
Well, because you have to go back and look at the narrative. It's been defined in a certain way. It's been received by the general public as a, not in a detailed way, but in a very vague way, really represented by that phrase, that misleading phrase in every single word, ground zero mosque, right? None of them accurate. As I said to an earlier question from the professor, I think once this is conceptualized, once this is received as the ground zero mosque controversy, you're going to get 70% against results. I mean, if that's how it's going to be framed, people aren't going to like it. There was every opportunity to frame it differently, and it was squandered.
One of the things I tried to raise in an article unsuccessfully, but is when we're talking about this project and Imam Rauf, I was trying to get at, like, is there any Muslim American who can pass the litmus test of what's considered like an acceptable imam, an acceptable religious figure? I mean, are we still at a point where, again, the things that are raised about him, some of them are things that, you know, I felt totally comfortable as a reporter taking seriously, such as, you know, his father was, you know, the leader at a Muslim center where they had imams who said, you know, maybe the Jews were behind 9/11 or some. I mean, you could say, well, what did you say about that? You were on the board of trustees. Did you speak out against that? I mean, things like that. But some of the things that are raised are, again, the same. You know, what's your position on Hamas? Like, that every Muslim is going to have to say what their position is on Hamas forever and ever and ever. And I don't know. I just thought, I think that's worth asking, is sort of like, who is there in the Muslim American community that would be considered acceptable?
I really think the answer is nobody if somebody wants to target you. Because if it's not you, it's someone you know. And if it's not someone you know, it's someone who is in the same organization you were. I mean, it becomes 7 degrees of separation. And it's impossible. It really is impossible at this point. And I can say, I mean, I don't think there's a bigger critic of Hamas than me in my entire community. I mean, I've been just about as nasty about them as you can imagine. I have a piece today online that's basically just trashing them because they deserve it. But I would never pass. I'd never even begin to pass. It would be a joke if someone tried to put me forward as some great, you know, oh, trust this guy, he's a mob. I mean, the number of accusations would be overwhelming.
I mean, does it have to do with I keep coming back to this. I don't know if you guys will disagree with me, but I mean, the age and sort of like roots of the Muslim community here, because I mean, basically, because if you look at, you know, some of these issues, you know, a lot of, on different sides. When I spoke to Grover Norquist about this, he was one of the many, many conservative leaders who refused to talk about these bloggers on the record. Refused. I mean, all the major conservative organizations would not comment about them on the record. But anyway, it is sort of looking at, you know, what kind of positions do like Muslim American leaders, what are they allowed to basically comment on? I mean, it just seems like, I don't know, it seems like we're still at a stage where there's just, I don't know, where it seems like we're still tied to the same conversations again and again. And some of them have to do with, some of them seem to, well, this is, I guess, everybody taking this issue and using it for their own purposes. But there are certain people that I talk to that, you know, this is, it's always about Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. And that's what this was really about.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, there's going to be people who are going to co-opt that. And maybe for national security people or religious freedom people or Israel, Palestine people, it is about that. That is their issue. And they just want to further, you know, whatever they see as the best outcome on that subject. I mean, but I really was kind of, you know, it was like people just right away, it's like Israel, Palestine, that's what's really behind this.
There are a lot of pitfalls out there. One of them is the Israel-Palestine thing, where if it's not you who said something, it's somebody you know or someone who was on a board with you or somebody said something. And there are many other pitfalls. Some of them are religious, some of them are social, some of them have to do with Israel-Palestine or U.S. foreign policy. There is, at heart, there is such a gap between the discourse in the American Muslim community and Muslims around the world, and on the one hand, and what is expected of mainstream discourse in the United States, especially when you're put under the microscope. And the room for maneuver is very, very small because the suspicion is very great, and people are parsing everything you said and everything your friends and relatives ever said to make the case against you. And you're guilty until proven innocent, and you really can't do that. And there will be something. There will be something against anybody under these circumstances. So really the answer to that question is no. That's one of the things we have to really challenge over the next sort of decade or so, is the notion that it is reasonable to take someone with a very established track record, which may be good or bad or whatever, and just distort it completely based on a few little bits and pieces. And that's what's done by a whole cadre of people who do it professionally, and ad hoc by some other people, and it really has had an extremely negative impact across the board in the Muslim community.
Well, when you said that there's a difference between the discourse in the Muslim world and what people are allowed to, what did you mean? That
no, what I mean is that the understanding, the perceptions about international relations, not only Israel-Palestine, but international relations across the board, among Muslims all over the world and American Muslims, and what constitutes a reasonable critique and what constitutes not a reasonable critique, and what values there are. I mean, so for example, I'll give you a very simple example. In the West, especially in the United States, and it's also very deeply believed in Israel, the intentionality behind an act of violence is determinative. What did you intend to do? So, in other words, if a civilian victim of a violent act was inevitable collateral damage, say there's a targeted assassination of someone who was blown up in a house full of 20 other people. Well, it's okay because we really weren't going after those 20 other people. We're going after this one guy who we can seriously claim, and I would likely agree with, was a legitimate target. And so, because our intention was not to kill those people, we are really not guilty of a terrorist act or anything like that. In the Muslim world, there's a very different way of looking at things, which is it is not a question of intention, it is a question of effect, especially inevitable effect. So in other words, I can tell you I know that you're going to blow away 30 people by doing this, and even if one of them is potentially a legitimate target, it is the same as a bomber who goes out deliberately to kill civilians without having a so-called legitimate target. And so in other words, it's a distinction about intention or effect. Now this is talking past each other. Very few people ever come down and say, all right, listen, we've got a problem of moral clarity here. We really need to discuss the terms of reference when we talk about, say, what constitutes an act of terrorism and why we would think that one thing is and one thing isn't an act of terrorism, why one thing is much more legitimate than the other and one is regrettable and the other is reprehensible, and you have a different frame of reference. It never comes down to that. There's a very clear prejudgment and a deep attachment to a kind of moral framework that is really questionable, and that where there's another perspective that is at this point unspeakable because it hasn't been articulated in a serious, thoughtful, sustained way. And what I just explained to you about this difference of perception, I bet you haven't heard it before. I really bet you haven't heard it before, but it explains so much about this gap in perceptions. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Yeah.
We've actually overrun our time for a bit, so we're unfortunately going to have to end the event here. Cool. But please join me in thanking our panelists. And this concludes our event. Thank you for attending.